Star jump sequence terminates, Captain.
Get the gravitational dampers online and open the blast shield.
Aye, sir.
Bring us in closer.
Aye, aye, sir. Moving us in on sublight drive.
Extreme magnification.
Aye, sir.
The center of the galaxy. And there's our black hole.
The experience of a lifetime, Captain.
Let me put this on audio. You should be able to hear the magnetic resonance.
This is it, ladies and gentlemen. The edge of time and space, where the impossible can happen. Welcome to the event horizon.
Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whatever is relevant for the part of the world you are in. Indeed, welcome to the Event Horizon, where the impossible happens. Join us each week at this time as we delve into the worlds of science fiction, fantasy, and science fact in all their forms. I am your host, Gene Turnbow.
And I am your other host, Susan Fox.
And with us is...
Marcus Elkanis, the director of new feature film, Warden. What? So if Superman is... What if a man with all the powers was a good man? This is what if a man with all the powers was just an ordinary man with ordinary problems or ordinary psychology. Is that about it?
That's it. That's it. First, thank you very much for having me here. Appreciate the space and happy and excited to be talking to you about Warden.
So this is what you did on your pandemic vacation in Brazil.
That's correct. Yeah, Warden. It came to me from the producers Steve Sarakinga and Jeff. Like, they sent me this script in 2019, and they had a little bit of financing, and this was set to be shot in the U.S. And it was written to be a kind of a fake documentary.
Yeah,
right?
Mockumentary.
Well, the mockumentary suggested it's a comedy. This is not a comedy.
Well,
it's like sort of faux documentary.
Yeah, uh-huh. Now they use faux documentary, so it feels like it's not a comedy. Of course, it's not. And I always loved that kind of format. You know, I try to watch everything that it's being released in that format. So when I read the script, you know, it had everything I liked, you know, in a film, especially as a director, you know, the themes. It was a superhero story, but told differently as kind of a documentary, and very realistically, and has this political element and this kind of a society reflection on our current state. But that was 2019, and we had a little bit of money to shoot. We're like gearing up for pre-production. Then all of a sudden, COVID hit, and, you know, I had other projects. Everything kind of fell apart. And then I even had to find a... because, you know, I started in the VFX industry, right? So I used to work as a visual effects artist for big movies like 300, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Tintin. And
boy, does it show.
I made the transition to directing, kind of like in maybe right now it's more than 10 years ago. And at the time it had been, I think, 7 years that I was already a director, and I had to stop because there was nothing going on for a director, you know, going on sets, everything was halted. And I decided to move back to the visual effects industry for a contract. And then I got this gig to work on The Mandalorian. And
excellent.
After work, it was a 6 month contract, really quick. So I worked and I made a little money working there. And with that money, I decided to finance Warden. So you can see it's not a lot of money, but I decided to finance myself and produce. And that was already the almost end of 2020, going for 2021. So I started to produce Warden with this shoestring budget. That was how it started.
It's got all the earmarks of a really good film. I mean, I watched some of it. I didn't watch the whole thing all the way through, but it is really well done from a narrative standpoint. I mean, the kinds of problems that a regular guy with you know, maybe not the best foundation in terms of his personal background.
This isn't quite Lex Luthor's worst nightmare, but it's a nightmare, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's thematically and on its core, it's a film that it's, you know, a regular guy gets powers and how it disrupts society. But in this, in the political terms in society, you know, we try to make it a what if very realistically. And of course, the documentary format, it helps it to ground in reality, because we couldn't, you know, fake reality. Otherwise, you pull the audience out of the documentary, right? So that was kind of always an exercise of how this would really happen, right? So that was a fun thing to do. And of course, it's a documentary. So it's not like people shouldn't expect the full of spectacles, flight scenes, and all that kind of big fights. And uh-huh. It's more of the perspective of newscast and people that worked, and officials and politicians, and you know, they all have their share of sharing how they see. So we never see it through the hero's eyes. It's always from someone's around his circle, right? And that what makes it kind of grounded, I believe.
Well, everything from the home movies to the news footage looks completely credible. can we play the soundtrack of the trailer? Let me ask that again so it sounds better on the radio. May we be allowed to play the soundtrack of the trailer so people can get a sense of what's going on?
Well, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. And
we boop. Do it, and we cut it in here.
Right. So, yeah, this is me saying okay. Boop with my mouth.
All right. So I was under the impression you would just play it right now.
Nah,
yeah, no, we're going to cut it in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The company motto is, we'll fix it in post.
Awesome.
Anyway, wow, I want to go see this movie now.
Yeah, the effects are absolutely credible, you know. I mean, it's in order to sell the rest of the film, the few effects that you do have to be spot on, and they clearly are.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned, my background is in VFX, so of course I could inject a little bit of production value doing the VFX myself. The problem is there are a lot of shots, even though in the film doesn't look like a lot of shots. You end up with, you know, 200 or 300 type of different type of VFX shots. So that takes a toll on me in terms of, you know, it's a low budget. But yeah, I think the VFX, it had to look absolutely realistic, because there's no room for, like, if you're showing a very realistic footage that looks like amateur footage, but with kind of this VFX that doesn't stick very well, it mm-hmm. just pulled people out of the film, right?
Yeah, it's contrasted to for perspective, a Marvel movie might have 900 shots, 900 VFX shots in it.
Yeah, even
something
more.
Like
I think
more.
Some of the Marvel movies, they might get like 1,500 shots or even 2,000 shots, depending. I've worked on shows that had more than 2,000 shots. So that's quite a lot, and they're all complex, mostly, you know, very, mm-hmm. and the companies have more than, I don't know, 700 people working on it.
Yeah, usually, so, yeah.
So you're doing the work of 100 people, basically, at a time.
Oh, I would say that.
I would.
Also, as a director, I would say I can, being the director, sometimes editing a little bit, and the VFX artist or supervisor, you're able to kind of control a little bit of the system. For instance, there's a scene that it's so hard to make it look good on the budget or within the time frame you have. So as a director, you just look again and say, do I really need that scene? It's really hard to pull that out. So you uh-huh. kind of come up with some creative changes and creative choices. Maybe you cut that scene, maybe you shrink that scene, maybe you just edit with sound. So you're able to fully control creatively. So I think that's the trick, you know, being traders of all hats. So you kind of like try to use your the freedom you have as a director to perhaps spare a few difficult VFX shots down the line and try to find other ways to convey the visual you need, right? So like that, it's, I have more flexibility than a typical VFX vendor that gets, the final cut, everything has to look great, and that's it. There's no much wiggle room. So I allow myself to have a little wiggle room, and sometimes that shot is looking great within the first 2 seconds, so I cut the rest and, do those choices here and there. So it's fun.
It must be great to, not have to send it to a to be your own VFX guy, do your thing, and not have to send it to the director and the studio and have them make decisions and then send it back to you to do over again with one small change or whatever. What a
Yeah, it's,
savings in time and nerves.
yeah, I mean, it's a different experience for sure. I've been in within the full spectrum of post-production. I've been the artist, I've been the VFX artist, VFX supervisor, animation supervisor, and director and producer. So in a way, once you start wearing all those hats, you start understanding that what really matters is the story, right? And the vision. And how you convey that, there's so many ways. So you try to play with that flexibility. There's a great film that it won even the VFX Oscar, which is Godzilla Minus One. And I don't know if you heard of that case.
Yes.
And they had like a very limited VFX team with probably 15 people. They won the Oscar against companies that has 700 people working on it. And their case, it's based on the director where was really close to the artist during production. So the director was in the same room as the artist. So that you shrink that bridge that usually you typically have on a big film, right? Which
Oh
is,
yeah, you said
have the
the
director and then the director talks to the VFX supervisor from the
VFX
studio side.
supervisor then talks to the VFX
Vendor
supervisor,
supervisor.
their supervisor in-house, who then talks to the production team, and it's a game of telephone. And
Exactly.
it takes a week to get anything done.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And I appreciate you being in the VFX industry too, right?
Oh yeah. I worked at Rhythm and Hues for about
Yeah.
10 years. So yeah,
So you know what
I know
I'm,
how it
you know what
works.
I Yeah, I love Rhythm and Hues' work. They were like an inspiration, because I think it was starting and they were out there already doing great work, and I was so sad when they closed down.
Yeah, well, believe me, a lot of us were. They
Yeah,
owed us
but
money.
yeah, in that sense as
They
well.
owed
I
us
mean,
money.
it's never nice, right, when a
Yeah,
big company
well,
like that
it's
closes.
yeah, there's a whole backstory to that I can get into another time. But it happened because of some major missteps from management, and they just read the room wrong and ended up going belly up.
I'm also being in a company that also went under. I wasn't there at the time, but it was after. There's always, missteps and choices that throughout the years it just kind of piles up. And but yeah, the VFX industry is such a hard industry because, as you know, there's lots of hours being spent. And sometimes just thrown away because it was just a choice that wasn't well interpreted from the artist, and you work for 100 hours, and all of a sudden you throw that out. So in the being the VFX industry kind of made me a little frustrated seeing that process happening. So when I'm directing my own films, even when I direct big commercials and bigger productions, I try to shrink that bridge between the director and the artist. I love seeing shots when they're still very rough, so I'm able to see and guide them through the direction instead of just seeing something close to final and just saying, oh, that's all wrong, guys. It's not the direction I wanted. And then they spend already 100 hours on that shot. I try
Right.
to,
Well, and it makes a huge difference when your director knows something about visual effects. So you don't have that extra communication layer of, okay, here's what I want how in the world are we going to do this? You already have an idea of how you're going to do it. You already have an idea of how much it's going to cost.
Yeah.
And whether it's going to be worth it to try it. And that totally makes a huge difference.
It makes, because I'm a believer that the VFX shot, you know, like let's not put VFX, but say like a shot that requires additional visuals. It starts in the conception, you know, even how, as a director, you thought of the angle, the lighting, because it makes everything easier down the road, even to conceive a good looking shot. At the end, it just, you know, depending how you shoot and the light you use and the direction you shoot, it just make the shot way more complex, right, to get. And you got to always have the story in mind and see ways of, you know, even tracking, you know, like depending how you move the camera, it's going to be a nightmare for them to get that. And some people just like to think that, oh, they get it later, you know, I don't care. But yeah, but I know there being hours being spent doing that, you know.
Yeah, but it's all in the prep. I mean, it's so many people that I've worked with just, you know, thunder on ahead and no thought at all to how they're going to fix whatever this is in post and whether or not they got all the elements they need.
Yeah, yeah, and I try to, you know, when I direct, and it's fun to me. It comes in a way that because I've been through the other side, it comes naturally. I instantly can see what I'm filming is going to work later on, because it's like a director who knows how to talk to actors, and directors, they learn how to talk to actors. They know how to talk to cinematographers, to editors. But and now I know VFX is a rather new discipline for a filmmaker. But I think at this time they should also know exactly how to talk to VFX artists or artists in general, right? Because most of them choose not to do it for some reason, and that makes everything more
which
expensive.
Is weird. I mean,
it's not for the weak.
Yeah, it's you have to set up your shots on the set with a visual effects supervisor so that he knows exactly what to tell the production people is coming and what they expect out of the shot, and to make sure that you get the coverage you need so that you have the raw elements to do the shot with. And, you know, you have to know what's going on. You have to know how to get the elements you need in order to get your shots. Otherwise you're making it up out of whole cloth and it costs 10 times as much.
And if you're in a low budget, I've seen a lot of good friends that, you know, shooting low budget films and even commercials, and being kind of held, I forgot the word, but they don't know what to do, how to do post-production, because now they're stuck with what they shot, and they don't have the money to pay someone to
fix
that.
Right, because they didn't get the coverage they needed when they were on the set.
Exactly.
And now they're screwed.
Yeah, that's why I love, you know, the more I understand about VFX, the less I want to use sometimes, you know, being like those older films, like Jurassic Park, and that it's about dinosaurs, but you only see dinosaurs maybe 6-10 minutes in the movie, and it's all in the direction. It's all like pretending there is a dinosaur behind that tree, right? And then you hear the sound, and that's a great directing, you know.
Yeah, that's good filmmaking. It's like Alfred Hitchcock used to do. It's like the camera would be on the actor, and you'd hear the whatever it was, you know, happening on the soundtrack, and then there'd be the dialogue to support whatever was going on, but you might not get to see exactly yourself.
It's called it's called suspense.
Yeah.
It's called suspense. There we go.
Yeah, and it's just it's one of the things. It's like Martin Scorsese when he did Razorfish.
Yeah.
He did that film. He picked that
You
film.
Never saw the fish, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, it's the film was done on an extremely tight budget, and he had, I forgot what the film was that he had done previously to that, but it hadn't done well. And he wanted to get back to his roots, you know, get back to what filmmaking was all about, which is, you have a very carefully prescribed box, and you have to fit your story within that box while at the same time making it appear as though there is no box at all.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the same principle is like in Jaws. That's why I love watching those movies, as and they consider me like a director who knows how to work with visuals, but I still like to watch those films so I don't have to use crazy visuals all the time, because that's great filmmaking. You know, it's more suggesting. And I think for the audience, it's even more interesting, you know, when you suggest instead of just showing everything. So you kind of, you know, I created a short film called The Flying Man. I don't know if you guys have.
Oh, yes, that was you. That was you?
Yeah, it was me.
Oh, okay. I remember that.
Yeah.
That was
really good. I think we wrote that up when it came out. We had an article on it on our website.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to hear that. Very, very, very. It's always great when, you know, when people just, oh, you did that. So, yeah, it's been.
And that film embraced some of the same concepts as the script does.
Exactly.
You know, the one that you produced for The Warden.
Yeah. And it's again, it's a different take on the superhero, right? It's seeing the superhero from a different angle, which I decided in that film to be from the criminal angle, from the criminal perspective, which makes it a horror film. So it's really like scary, because the criminal is being haunted by the superhero, which is kind of a monster movie now.
Mm-hmm. To the cowardly criminals, Batman is the horror of the horror movie, isn't he?
Yeah.
The whole point of
the superhero trope is that the superheroes have to have very, very rigid systems of ethics and morals, and they have to know how to work within the system of the societies they're in, or they lose the respect of that society.
And I think that'll be the turning point of Warden.
Yeah, and that's what The Warden is really all about.
Because you blurred that line, right? And to me, it always bothered me that someone with so much power, it would probably make their own rules. It's almost like a human thing in a way, because every member of society, we kind of agree with some laws, we disagree with some others, and there's always that kind of a, you know, balance that you agree and disagree. But imagine if someone has so much power that he might just follow the rules for some time, but then at one point he's just going to disagree with something, and maybe he still follows, but at one point he's just going to cross the line saying, you know what, I'm not doing this this way anymore on this specific point. And then you go rogue, right?
And then you end up with Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
You know, and that's also, you know, that whole series is a cautionary tale, kind of cut from the same cloth.
Yeah. And I mean, those are the themes that that interest me in exploring. And I think superheroes are so interesting because you can explore, like, you already have comics that explore those things, you know, the Watchmen, and you have others that explore different perspectives, like Marvel's that I also love. And I think that the people's point of view have always interested me more than the origin story as per se. So that's why I picked those. Of course, I love some of the recent superhero films as well. But you know, as a filmmaker, especially from my standpoint, I'm trying to do things to maybe bring some eyes to what I'm doing. And if you try to emulate what people are doing, you have less chances to attract that attention. That's why
I made
The Flying Man, which at the time, you know, to this day it has 25 million views. So, and people are still constantly rediscovering the film. Mm-hmm. Now because of Warden, people are visiting again the film. You know, it has 100,000 views in the last week.
Whoosh.
Yeah, it's crazy. And they say, oh, how come I just found this today? Thanks to the algorithms too.
Yeah,
The people keep rediscovering. But I mean, for a filmmaker that, you know, Flying Man, I did at the time with $4,000. It was also did all the VFX myself. And it was the time when I switched the industry. Like I was working in New Zealand at Weta Digital and Tintin and and Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And they offered me an extend of contract. And then I said, no, I'm going to switch. I'm going to try to direct. And I went back to Canada. And I was at home for, I don't know, a year, just doing my own, you know, writing my own stuff and doing Flying Man and spending all the money I made in the last years. And at one point I said, what am I doing with my life? But then came out Flying Man, and that changed everything for me. That kind of gave me a directing career, which, you know, still is still a constant battle, right, for you to direct and pay bills and stuff like this. But I can't complain.
At the same time, it's great to greenlight your own stuff.
Yeah, it's something that it's, you know, I've been all those years trying to make films and trying to make features. And then when I realized I was able to maybe get Warden off the ground on my own resources, it's liberating. In a way, it's like you feel really good. I don't even feel like I'm spending money or you know, because in a way it's an investment. You either get back from like renting your film, but you also get back with good energy, and you're just putting another work out there, and people start, you know, giving you other looks, and maybe they give work, maybe they consider you for other things. And I always
I hope
different...
so. Well, you'd be dangerous with a big budget.
I mean, I had great experience doing short films, you know, like every short, I always spend my own money, you know, and of course I pay people and everything, but it's all my money. And I'm never doing that to have money back, but mostly to, you know, get work back. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm always looking for. Give me work. You don't need to pay me. I mean, of course you have to pay.
But I'm not
looking to sell my shorts, you know what I mean? But it's been fun. You know, I've been doing that for the last 10 years, at the same time directing commercials. So the commercials help you to go through it and also get more experience on sets and different gears, different places. It's great. So I do both at the same time.
So tell us about your cast. Your star is Giovanni De Lorenzi.
Yeah.
Stars as Daniel.
The cast is very international. We have Brazilians, we have French, Belgian, we have British, American, and they were all based in Brazil at the time. Like I said, we decided to adapt to shoot in Brazil because that story was supposed to happen in a small city in the U.S. But because of the pandemic, say, oh, okay, now I can shoot in Brazil because I'm stuck here in Brazil.
Right.
With, you know, with all the
that was kind of okay because we're not seeing the same old buildings, the same old New York buildings, or the same old Atlanta buildings that we always see, you know?
Yeah, it's a good point. It kind of gave a little, you know, a little something different. And of course, we had to adapt the script. So in a way, it's a story now that happens in Brazil. But funny enough, the adaptation was very little. It was kind of a story that worked. It pretty much works in all Western society if you just switch if you switch the cities. Of course, we had, like in the U.S. perspective, we had a little bit of a thing with the army as well, some flirtation with the army, but we took that away because in Brazil, you know, people don't wouldn't buy that part of the story. So in a way, it was very little adaptation. You know, how we call DA in Brazil is different, and how the police works in Brazil is tiny differently from the U.S. So things like that. But I think the society part, it's very similar, you know, social media, the celebrity thing, and it's how, you know, all this Western thing kind of react. So it was fun. In a way, it was a good exercise for us to understand even better what we're trying to do. So we kind of went for the casting. So it was all remote. So I went for those names that I, you know, was researching, because we didn't have many resources even to open a big casting call and or anything like that. So I was just researching, and I had worked with Giovanni Pryor in another superhero short film I did called The Great Kinesio. It's a 3-minute short film that I loved making. If you had the chance, you can watch it. It's really short and nice, and it was done with Giovanni. So I knew like he had something that he could offer for Warden. And then, you know, obviously the film is spoken mostly in English because we consider it's an international perspective of a story that happened in Brazil. So we kind of kept some of the casting international, the characters, right? And I knew some of those actors were working in Brazil at the time. So I reached out and they all responded really well to the script. So, and they were sending their audition. I was getting excited, of course, as a director, you know, kind of producer, director. And it was during a time that not a lot of people were working, right? It was
pandemic. Yeah.
They're all, so in a way that helped us because it was easier to reach people. So they were just home waiting for something. And then, hey, you want to be part of this film and send the script. They were excited. So they had time to record themselves and send back. And those interview parts, the way we produced those, it was, times were still strict. So it was basically me and the actor, right? So I had one day with each actor and I went to shoot an interview myself with two cameras, microphone, everything. I was operating everything, two cameras, a microphone, lights, even a little makeup sometimes. I would find a different location for each character. That production, the way we design production, was interesting because differently from a regular film that you need an actor for 10 days or 20 days, this one, I only needed most of the characters for one day because it was an interview.
Uh-huh.
So I was able to negotiate one day rate with each one of them. So it was easier in a way to get everybody on board because I only had
right,
one
because
day.
They weren't doing scenes together. And they weren't doing, you didn't have locations or, you know, for the most part, you didn't have locations that required.
Yeah. Just Giovanni had 4 or 5 shooting days because he had more scenes about him, right? Because he's his warden. But at the same time, I needed very good actors because each character, because it's an interview, right? It's a documentary. Each actor had an average of 15 pages of dialogue that they had to just throw at the camera in one shot almost. Of course, we had stopping from here and there, but they were all able to memorize. It was very little improv. I think Jeff Duha's lines were really well written in a way that the actors felt true to the words, so they didn't have to improv, you know, say, I wouldn't say it this way. So it was, that really helped because then actors had time to prepare, so they memorized. They went really prepared on set, and I'd had zero problems. And I believe their performances are natural, and because it's tricky.
Oh yeah, especially in something like this, it's very easy to just go, oh well, this is a documentary. I can just be myself and read the lines, and then the lines have no energy or no impulse, and they don't cut well with other footage. You didn't seem to have that problem. I mean, what I noted about the interview segments that I saw was that they all felt like super, super engaged and super genuine to what was going on. That was really impressive.
Yeah, the witnesses were as excited as a real witness would be. The interviewers were very close and professional about it. It's acting. Hello.
Yeah, they're good at it. They're good at it. You got good actors.
I mean, when you don't have enough budget, I think the only thing you can really go for is the best actor your money can buy. And because of the times, I was able to get great actors that weren't looking necessarily for a big payday in a way to, I got like grade A actors in Brazil to play very complex characters and with a lot of lines. I mean, they had 20 pages. Usually an actor, for someone that is listening that hasn't had the experience on set, usually you shoot 4 to 5, 6 pages a day in a feature film. And that 6 pages includes sometimes 5 characters with a couple lines here and there. So usually for an actor, they need to memorize, you know, a couple paragraphs per day. This one, like, they had to memorize pages of complex and, you know, text that, you know, and there was no teleprompter.
Right. So it's a So that's
and
a
it's
challenge.
Not just memorizing. You gotta act, right? You gotta feel that character and feel what you're saying. So on that aspect, I was very lucky, right? I think for me, the biggest challenge was always the visuals, because what happens is, I knew this is a low budget film, and I knew it suffers if you don't put a lot of coverage, because interviews alone, they people get tired of just talking heads, right? And I knew just with the interviews, I would have a film, right? But it would cut from a talking head to another talking head to another talking head, and it would get very boring. So I knew I had to have coverage. But the coverage costs a lot of money because, right, of course, you got to act. You know, there was a kidnapping of a bus, and then you had this, you know, this riot on the streets. And how am I going to depict that in a way that I don't break my bank? So it was always trying to hit that balance of, okay, this is getting too boring here. We need coverage to get the people to see. And I wish I had more money to get more coverage. And I believe we strike the balance that people will realize, well, I wish they had more money to add more cool scenes, but I appreciate what they did here. Hopefully they see this way. I think the story, it's the story, I think, you know, from the script, it's there. I think people can get through it, and it's interesting. It's an interesting reflection. I'm seeing almost as a fan of the script as well, right? Because I made the film, but when I read the script, it felt interesting to me. So I wanted for more people to find it interesting too.
Well, everyone can find it interesting in the USA. We can see it on Prime Video. And we'll probably do that in the next day or two, because I want to see how it ends, or if it ends.
Yeah, it's on Prime, Apple, I think Google Play.
Yeah, Google
YouTube.
Play has it. YouTube has it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that pay for play YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah, and also cable. I think you're able to see pretty much everywhere you have on-demand systems.
That's really your distribution on this is really impressive. Even getting that much done is just that's something.
Well, if we all kick in a couple of bucks, you can make a bigger movie next time.
I wish. I mean, again, like I mentioned, we're in a very good turning point for The Flyman, which is, I'd say, my baby since I started directing, and it has been everywhere at this point. We had a deal with Columbia Pictures at one point. We developed there for 2 years. But the studio decided not to pursue it
probably,
for many reasons.
Probably people at the top changed chairs or...
Yeah, that happens a lot, yeah. Actually. You know, you start with a set of executives and you finish with another set. Presidents, they change, and it's a big... It's a constant change, right? So I realized, like, making a film in the Hollywood system, it takes resilience. Most of all, because sometimes it's not your film that it's not suitable or whatever. It's just the way dynamics work, and you might just get lucky, but you got to be trying. You got to be there. And I'm trying to be resilient. And now it's because of work, and it's there's something happening right now that I can say much yet, but it's very promising. And I'm still... We have a script that, of course, we're going to keep developing, and I'm really hopeful to make this. And because I like the material, and I think after 10 years, I think it's testament that I, you know, when you get the same material for 10 years and you still believe that, I think it's a sign of something, right? You
got to be yes, that is that means something when something that you've got is good enough to stand up
To time, yeah. And yeah. I mean, the YouTube short still being watched, which, you know, it's always a good sign. Because as a filmmaker, it's hard when you make something, you don't know exactly what to think anymore. So you got to see what other people are telling you, how they receive the material, because that material might be timely. It might just pass time and they're not engaging anymore. There's that too. So you never know exactly how that will ring with audiences, which is scary and exciting at the same time. So Flying Man still, you know, happening in the internet, which is always great to see. And for me as a filmmaker that spend my own money, it's always rewarding to see an audience feedback. I love it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with Marcus
Elkeres
about the film Warden. It's available on Hulu and YouTube and lots of different places.
Apple, Amazon, lots of other things starting with A.
And it looks really sharp and well-produced. And I'm looking forward to seeing the entire film. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Gene. Thanks, Susan. And thanks a lot for the space and, you know, for discussing Warden. And it's really appreciated. I'm really appreciated to, you know, to be here. And because after all, like, we do this for the audience, to find an audience, to find new eyes. And I appreciate your show. And I know you have a great audience. And to me, this is very valuable, you know, to spread the word and have more people to find about work. And even, you know, if they want to see different things, that's the way to support it, the different things. And one thing I can promise in Warden, it's different. It's different from everything they saw.
It absolutely is. Thank you again, Marcus.
Thanks, Gene. Thanks, Susan.